honoring faith, Bible, and ethics, a new conversation. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Sharon. Well, it's always great to be back at Holden. Nyla and I are here for 2 weeks this time. And as Sharon indicated, last week we started under the same theme, Earth Honoring Faith, but a different subject. That was Journey of the Universe, which is a story of the universe from the Big Bang to the present. This week we'll continue with that rubric overall, Earth Honoring Faith. What is Earth Honoring Faith? And we'll move to a different topic or a related topic, but Bible and ethics, a new conversation. The emphasis is on a new conversation. There's always been conversation of Bible and the moral life. Now, on the board in the kiosk, you have this description for this week, and I'm just going to read it out. Earth is changing in ways it hasn't for hundreds of thousands of years. At the same time, Christianity is breaking away from its millennium-long geographical and cultural center in the Europe and the West. Its growth in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, primarily in Pentecostal, evangelical, and independent churches. These dramatically change planetary planetary and ecclesial landscapes have led many to conclude that we need a new way of thinking about our collective existence. Who are we? And what is the nature of our responsibility in this deeply altered world? This sets the stage for a new conversation. Reading scripture in light of our deeply altered context. How does the Bible now shape our collective identity and inform our character and conduct? Ethics is about character and conduct. And there'll be, how many are new this week to this session? Okay, for those of you who happened to be here last year, in this session, the first part of it, I'm going to describe the context. That was very much the context that we operated with last year. And then we'll go off to specifically to Bible and ethics. And last week we said we need new stories or transform stories in two different domains. One domain is the kind of, who are we as human beings in the scheme of things in a deeply altered world, a deeply changed planet? Bill McKibben writes a book called Earth. He spells it E-A-A-R-T-H because he says we don't live on the same planet we were born on. So it's species talks. Who are we as human beings now in this context? But that's not the only story that needs to be where we need what Thomas Berry called a new story or a grand narrative. The other one is as U.S. Citizens. Who are we now in the light of what is going on in this country? So there's a need for a new story of being America, or a change story, or a transform story. And those two will go together, this search for new stories. This week in the light of conversation about Bible and ethics. I think, personally, that the deepest divide in this nation right now is a division, and it doesn't fall exactly along the lines of parties, is the deepest divide between those who are striving for a segregated existence of some kind. It's me and my tribe. We're the ones that need to be telling the story, and that's for whom the story is told. The divide between segregated existence of some kind and those who are trying to work out a different story on the basis of the diversity of the nation. That will shape my take on one of these stories. But the other one is the one I'm going to focus on this morning. The division, I mean, the species question, who are we as Homo sapiens in a deeply altered, on a deeply altered planet? Okay. The reason I put this description up here is not just to give an overview. This is the description that's on the kiosk, and it's the same description for all three sessions this week, but they're not the same session three times. So we'll start at one today. This description will still be up there, but it'll be a different treatment of it. All right. Well, we want to have some fun. That's just talking about very serious things. This is what happens when you cut down too many trees. And in an important way, this is our question. I'm going to describe the change in geological epochs that is happening. It's the first time ever in the human story that human beings have changed geological epochs that are framed there. And it is certainly the first time that humans have been the primary cause of changes on that scale. So for Christian ethics and for peoples of other faiths, Jewish, Muslim, Hinduism, how do we hem the planet in what is now being called the Anthropocene, the early Anthropocene? Anthropocene from the Greek New Testament, if you will. Anthropos, the human. Age of dominance of human activity. For the first time, we are the single most powerful force of nature itself. And it's the dominance of human activity that's shaping the planet. Oceans, atmosphere, land masses, melting of the Arctic and the Antarctic, Greenland ice sheet. All of this is a consequence of human choices and action. That's why their sessions this week are Bible and ethics. Could be Bible and liturgy. Might have been Bible and aesthetics, arts, and so on. The reason we're focusing on Bible and ethics is because it is, the changes are all grounded in our choices and actions as human beings. That's what ethics is about. And so that's the prominence. There aren't, I don't care, your breakfast is a moral issue. Where did those bananas come from? Where did that coffee come from? What are the global supply lines? What were the consequences for the peoples in the land that brought them to you? There isn't anything. Your commute is a moral issue. All in the Anthropocene, all of the consequential issues are ethical in that sense that they are grounded in our choices and our action. Now, a lot of what we need to pay attention to is brought to us by science. Not all of the sciences, but the geologists, the climatologists, the oceanographers, the atmosphere scientists, they are the ones that are telling us what is happening to the planet as a consequence of a fossil-fueled civilization that started around 1750 with the Industrial Revolution. There are roots of our present way that go back far before that. But we're going to focus on what has happened since 1750 to change the planet, and especially since 1950. After World War II was a time of dramatic changes. But spending our time on science graphs will send everyone into PowerPoint coma. So I've decided another route for introducing the Anthropocene. This is truly new territory for all of us, and including us as a species. And the way I'm going to do that is read you a letter that I've written to our grandson about our life and his life. So here is the 3.5-year-old Brooklyn philosopher who's contemplating his future. Dear Eduardo, this is a love letter, but not the usual. Of course, Graham and Isla and I, together with your abuela y abuelo in Colombia, match doting grandparents anywhere. Our affection lacks nothing. But this letter is unique because it's the first love letter consciously written by a grandparent who lived in one geological epoch to a grandchild living in another. No other letter in the whole history of love knowingly sends love from a grandpa in the late Holocene to a toddler in the early Anthropocene. That's weird. It's also important because the Anthropocene is the time of your life, while the late Holocene is the time of mine. This language rings strange to me. Yet probably not to you if you are reading this as a 16 or 18-year-old. Unlike me, you will experience the tumultuous changes that ride astride a new geological epoch. While human history and human experience was my main subject, Earth science and planetary experience will likely be yours. You will learn big history, where the human drama is a chapter in Earth's drama, even a chapter in the journey of the universe. So you already know from school and your smartphone watch that Holocene means the wholly recent epoch, while Anthropocene, yours, means the age of the human. That's from the Greek anthropos. God only knows why geologists all speak Greek, but they do. I realize it's hopelessly nerdy to include a graph. What love letter features a science graph? Follow the purple line. That's the temperature variation across the last 11,000 years. The last 11,000 years is the late Anthropocene. The temperature varies from less than 1 degree Celsius above the baseline to less than 1 degree below it. This minimal difference is rare in Earth's history. Look at the line before it turns purple. The minimal variation means that the geological grammar of the epoch that has hosted every single human civilization to date, bar none, is climate stability. Uncommon stability, permitting and generating a riot of life. My lifetime and Graham and Isla's fall to the far right of this 11,000 years, where purple takes a sudden turn and heads straight up, with more to come. That temperature spike is the early Anthropocene, and it's where I leave my life behind and you begin yours.
You cannot know what I would give so that you did not live out your days on that trajectory. That line, your life, is climate instability, mass uncertainty, and breathtaking extinction across the community of life. On that line, tragedy looms, and I pray you are able to wring adaptation from distress. What I know is that Anthropocene citizens who continue Holocene habits doom their children. Nonetheless, the world has not stopped being beautiful. So claim the beauty that is. Beauty is its own resistance. Nor has love stopped being love. Even a wounded world holds us. In any event, you and I will have precious days together in the great transition that will define every day of your life and the last ones of mine, the transition from industrial to ecological civilization. However many years that takes, but surely your lifetime, may well turn out to be the branching point between calamity and wisdom. For it to be wisdom and not calamity, we will all need to learn how to let go of this fossil-fueled consumerist world and love all the things that climate cannot change. Did you know that the year you were born, 2015, was the decisive one in several ways? It was the warmest on record to that point. In the first days of December alone in the United States, 1,426 high temperature records fell when you were 10 months. We shouldn't be surprised, since the year before, 2014, was the hottest until then, and the hottest 17 years all occurred in the last 20. In May, when you were about 3 months, CO2 passed 400 parts per million for the first time in all human history. And half the climb to 400 parts per million happened after 1980. The present 411 parts per million is not only the highest carbon concentration in 800,000 years, but the rate of emission is increasing. Your birth year saw unprecedented response as well. On December 12th, the 195 nations signed the Paris Climate Agreement, a political miracle, even when everyone there knew it was only the first step, and in order to stave off runaway catastrophe, greenhouse gas emissions must drop to zero by 2050, when you are 35. One nation, under Trump rather than under God, is exiting the Paris Agreement. Just as all of the dour records of your birth year were being broken in your second year and will be again in your third. As I write, it's monster storms, hurricanes Harvey, Irma, Maria, and Jose, and it's wildfires in both Northern and Southern California. In Barrow, Alaska, the climate monitoring station dropped off the map. Its algorithms found the warming data so unreal, they simply wiped it out. They cleaned the slate. The algorithms had no place for a new normal that far out of range. I suspect our Holocene habits are similarly tuned. Our habits, in effect, clean the slate. And so we look at climate system change, and then we look away. Another 2015 response came earlier in June, the papal encyclical Laudato Si. I'll not exegete it, only say that it is the single most powerful indictment to date of how the modern world has gone wrong. Moreover, it challenges the Paris Agreement, what the Paris Agreement still enshrines, namely the orthodoxy of perpetual economic growth within the framework of global corporate capitalism. The encyclical speaks of climate change impacts as catastrophe and disaster, while the Paris Accord uses the tepid language of adverse effects, never acknowledging anything truly fundamentally wrong with our dominant paradigms. And the Pope dares to say what the Paris Agreement does not, that the happiness of the rich is subsidized by the suffering of the poor and of all creation. Happiness comes with the debt that economic privilege exacts day by day from womb to tomb. The third turning point all but mentioned you by name. It was the filing of Juliana V. et al. V. the United States. 21 children and youth, backed by an organization called Our Children's Trust, brought suit against the U.S. government. The children's suit argues that the government holds resources such as land and water in trust for all of its citizens and should be considered a trustee of the atmosphere as well. How this quest for genuine intergenerational rights turns out, you will know. However it turns out, I'm clear about yet another development, a certain emerging consciousness. In these latter days of the Holocene, we have become aware of ourselves as short-lived creatures on a small planet in a long-lived galaxy and countless planets. This cosmology of wonder and the journey of the universe is not only sound science, it's our identity. Short-lived though we be, our origins are stellar. Eduardo, we are stardust. The calcium in your teeth, the iron in your blood, and the gold of a wedding band of a commitment you might someday wear are all gifts of exploding supernovae, big stars. The grace of star death funded your life. It really does take a universe to raise a child. You, the little brother you tell me is swimming in your mommy's tummy, and all your friends, ancestors, pet turtles, and progeny. So maybe the Crow Nation is right. We love the stars, they sing, and the stars love us back. What I most want for you and your baby brother is that you lose yourself in the kaleidoscope of creation. Be overwhelmed, but be overwhelmed with wonder. Not in order to escape the world, but better to inhabit it. I've loved watching you plant tiny carrot seeds in the little seedling pots, then seeing your delight in the first green pushing through as you carry the seedling so carefully to the raised bed on the deck and plant it there. A carrot grows in Brooklyn. Yet to date, this cosmology of cosmic wonder is without translation into law or even into conventional consciousness. My prayer is that the children's lawsuit, together with the papal encyclical, might join the cosmology of wonder and the intergenerational ethic that it reaches for. I finish this letter on a related note. As a Christian ethicist, I ground obligation in a moral universe of all the children. All the children alludes to the dedication in Thomas Berry's book, The Great Work, Our Way into the Future. Here's the dedication. To the children, to all the children, to the children who swim beneath the waves of the sea, to those who live in the soil of the earth, to the children of the flowers in the meadows and the trees in the forest, to all the children who roam over the land and the winged ones who fly with the winds, to the human children too, that all the children may go together in the future in the full diversity of their community. All the children, translates as full-bore rights of nature, ourselves included. Its moral universe understands planetary creation as sacred, seamless, and interdependent, a single, complex, luminous ecosphere. Like Genesis, this creation is also deemed good. All the children are worthy of the public trust the children's lawsuit seeks. And since no other species has lawyers, it must be our law for everyone's sake, all the children's. My dear child, I must break off for now. I do so with a heavy heart, because I know that, wholly against Grandma Nyla's and my will, we hand you a bitter irony. Measured by our planetary imprint, the world we hand you is the most human of all epochs. It is also the most dangerous. And with no choice whatsoever on your part, you will have to live with that. Grandma Nyla and I and our ancestors lived our whole life on a single fatal premise, namely, that what was good for us would be good for the world. But we have been wrong. The biggest question itself was one we learned too late. Namely, we asked what humans want from life, but what counts is what life wants from humans. It's a very big question, what life wants from humans, to be sure. Too big for people alone. But people aren't alone, and have never been. There's God and the universe and the riot of life for 3 billion years on this third rock from the sun. So the contrary assumption was right, namely that what was good for the world would be good for us. We've learned too late that because human well-being is always derivative, creation's well-being is always primary. Next time, I'll write about the dilemma of the Anthropocene and more joyful things. We have to catch a boat and then a bus to a remote village in the Cascades right now. So I must sign off. I send all my love, Grandma Nyla's too. Te amo, Grandpa. P.S. I have a request. If by the time you read this as a young man, I am dead, as dead I well may be, would you join your mother's lovely voice at my memorial service? And would you sing not just any song, rather this one, where your living and my dying meet in a love that bridges even geological epochs? You'll sing it in Spanish, but here's the English. In all our living, we belong to God. And in our dying, we are still with God. So whether living or whether dying, we belong to God. We belong to God. Okay. Now, that's an introduction to the Anthropocene as our planetary context for talking about Bible and ethics. But let me ask first whether there's anything you want to respond to in the letter, especially issues of clarity. Was there something I said that isn't clear, or you want to explore a bit of the implications of it? So I'll just give you time to pose anything you might want to. Don't need to, but I want it to be clear what I said because it's kind of the basis. Yes.
I didn't catch the title of Thomas Berry's.
Oh, yes. Thomas Berry, B-E-R-R-Y. I mean, you can't make this up. People in eco-theology, it's Thomas Berry, it's Wendell Berry, it's Matthew Fox, it's Judith Plant. I don't know what's going on here. But this is Thomas Berry. And it's The Great Work, Our Way into the Future. Yeah. Yes.
Could you put the graph back up?
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes. Actually, yes. Certainly can. Yeah. And as I said, here's your baseline, zero up here. And these are the years, 20,000 years ago. We know this from tree dendrology, tree rings. We know it from ice cores, etc. You can now, scientists can now recreate not just the atmosphere, biochemistry, the chemistry of the atmosphere. They can also recreate temperatures. So you see how erratic the green line is until you get to about 11,000 years ago, which is the late Holocene, the recent epoch. And then the temperature variation doesn't go more than 1 degree above or 1 degree below, 1 degree Celsius. So a few degrees, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, until you get over to this point, and it may not be altogether clear, but you see the purple alongside the rust one? That's the temperature spike in our time. And that's the early Anthropocene. And as I tried to emphasize, the contrast is between the kind of full body tattoo of climate stability in the Holocene and the climate volatility and uncertainty in the Anthropocene. We don't know exactly where that purple line is going to go if we keep burning, since the primary cause is the burning of fossil fuels. It depends a whole lot on whether we quit doing that.
And the year zero here?
Good question. Yeah, that comes comes late in the late Anthropocene, so it's a way of trying to measure from the end of that geological epoch, the late Anthropocene, to what now happens in the next, which is the early Anthropocene. So it's a new epoch. Yes?
The emissions are going down, but the spike is going up.
Yeah.
Could you explain why?
Yes. Emissions are going down in some places, including the United States. Nonetheless, the temperature is going up, and that's because CO2 emissions are cumulative, and they hang in the atmosphere for a very long time. So when it's cumulative, you can be decreasing the rate, decreasing the emissions, and still adding to the total emissions. And that's the temperature change. Now, there isn't any dialing back on climate change, because you can't take those CO2 emissions, excess emissions, out of the atmosphere under present kind of technology. Lots of people are working on trying to do that. But you're not going to subtract them. And the climate is so deeply affected by the oceans. I mean, jet streams, for example, are heavily regulated by ocean watering, water warming and cooling. And great bodies of water absorb heat slowly and give it off slowly. The oceans have become sinks of CO2 emissions. So it means that we're in for warming years, for as far as we can see, because the oceans have absorbed so much CO2 that has warmed them, and the warming, the cooling of them takes a long time. So there are, the dynamics here are such that you don't just dial it back. If we cut emissions a lot by 2025, you would still have consequences that come from what's happening right now. Yeah. All right, let me give you a summary of this letter as to our place as human beings. In the consequence of this warming is that nature has changed course at our hand. That's what McKibben was trying to tell us with a different spelling of Earth. Secondly, and we've already emphasized this, in contrast to the climate stability of the Holocene, the mark of the Anthropocene is climate instability, eco-social uncertainty, and mass extinction. Mass extinctions are very rare in the planet's history. There have only been 5 in 3 billion years of life. The planet has been around 4 billion, but we haven't had life. First single cells, and then multicells, and then a kind of explosion of life in different geological epochs, extinctions now and again. And there have been 5 mass extinctions. I underline mass because species die and species emerge all the time. So the species go extinct and species arise all the time. But that kind of normal process in the natural world is different from mass extinctions. And 90-some percent of the species that have lived in the course of life on the human planet have gone extinct. We're now in the 6th mass extinction. What is different about this one is that it is caused by human beings. So that's a word there. And then the mark of the Anthropocene, humankind has become a geological force. We've always been a force of nature. I mean, think about the agricultural revolution. We're always changing landscapes. But we've never been a geological force before. Our powers are now exercised cumulatively across generational time, aggregately through ecological systems, and non-intentionally over evolutionary futures. In other words, the time dimensions of the consequences of our action and the space dimensions of the consequences of our action have both expanded. We, in fact, have shaped things in such a way that evolution as it goes on will happen within certain constraints rather than a more open-ended thing. This fact that we now impact generations to the third and fourth generation, probably more than that, of those who come after us, that's cumulatively across generational time, or the fact that we affect all ecosystems, including ocean bottoms. I mean, coral reefs are dying as a consequence of warming, which is a consequence of fossil-fueled industrial civilization. This aggregately throughout ecological systems, we've always had impacts on them, but this is thorough, and then non-intentionally over evolutionary futures. This swells human responsibility to new and unprecedented dimensions. So we have to look at the consequences of all of our choices and actions now. Let me see if I can find I'll give you a couple of famous graphs and we'll come back to... these are now famous graphs which capture what has happened.
Larry?
Yeah?
Before you go on, doesn't anybody else want to know what the 5 extinctions are, what the sixth one that we're living in is, I do.
Yeah, and I can't. I'll have to get back to you on that, on the names of them. They end eras, so this may be the end of the Cenozoic era. First of all, I should say that geologists have eras, epochs, and ages, and we're talking about a shift in epoch. But even bigger than that, a number of geological epochs within an era. And the talk now is because there was a mass extinction that ended the Cenozoic. Dinosaurs got wiped out. That actually made room for mammals, even though they're small mammals, and small mammals co-evolved with lots of dinosaurs. But that era is a part of the Cenozoic. We're probably at the end of the Cenozoic era as well. Geologists are more ready to talk about the shift of epoch, not the end of an era yet. All right. That's actually fascinating. Do you know that the dinosaurs lived the beginning of the age of the dinosaurs to the end of the age of the dinosaurs was longer than the end of the age of the dinosaurs to us? I mean, they had a good run. We would be well to mimic the dinosaurs with respect to longevity. That would be excellent. All right. Now, how did we get to this point of affecting a change of geological epochs? The date and all of these graphs, they're called hockey stick graphs or J-curve graphs. The date on the left is 1750, which is the conventional date for the onset of the Industrial Revolution. The single great invention was a few years earlier, I think it's 1732, and that's the steam engine. The steam engine replacing horses, and the steam engine using coal. So once you had an ability to take stored energy in compact form and extract it from Earth, and you had the capacity to burn it anywhere in a machine that replaced 500 horses, you then had the capacity to have the human built environment built anywhere that you could take the steam engine and use coal or later oil and gas. I mean, this key that you had stored compact energy in a form that you could find and take anywhere rather than having to rely on the seasons and their stipulations in a particular locale. That's huge. So that's the onset of the Industrial Revolution. Now, of course, we don't have, not going to have much data for motor vehicles in 1750. So this is a blank line. McDonald's restaurants, okay, as I've often said, there are lots of McDonald's in Scotland. They probably had some restaurants. We don't have the data on McDonald's restaurants early on there. What's so interesting about this graph is that the shape of the curve is the same, even though the factors don't look like they're even related to one another. I mean, what's the relationship of the damming of rivers got to do with fertilizer consumption, got to do with McDonald's restaurants? What's the direct foreign investment got to do with telephones? Might have some. International tourism. Well, the two drivers of all of these graphs, this one and the next page, are the top two. It's human population, and it's, you should translate total real GDP into the global human economy. It's total activity. And the second page I will show you, you'll see the same graphs, but the consequences for the planet are there. This graph and the next one are often referred to as the Great Collision. The Great Collision is the collision of the human economy with nature's economy. Nature's economy is the one in which the human economy is fully immersed, and upon which it is totally dependent. So if they are at, if that's a collision of those two, then you got trouble. I'm going to get to your question, but I want to say first of all that you see the dramatic change at 1950 and after. That's the end of Second World War. Thousands, tens of thousands in this country of young people came back from the war. They needed jobs. Economies were devastated. Countries were devastated in Europe and in Asia. They needed to be rebuilt. In the Roosevelt administration, the latter days, and then in the Truman administration, there was a deliberate policy direction, and it was to build a global consumerist economy. And the institutions were put in place for that at Bretton Woods, World Bank, IMF, International Monetary Fund. These were global institutions directing what was to be a global consumerist economy. It was the right thing at the time. Human history has never seen the growth that happened between 1950 and 1975 in a way that brought a large middle class. Everybody was better off. There are exceptions because there were people who were excluded from that. But it was an unprecedented quarter century for an unprecedented amount of increase in material abundance. So that's why 1950 is there. Now, go ahead.
Just a question about the water in this graph before 1900.
Yeah. Well, just to say, it's more of it is being extracted for human use. So this is primarily, mostly about agriculture and its water use in what became more and more monocropping. Monocropping is old. Slavery was there because you needed workers for cotton, tobacco. So monocropping and the growth of capitalism goes back a while. But the water use here is both agriculture and look at the population increase. So urban water use also grows rapidly. Now, I said these two graphs are the ones that drive all of this, and they drive the next page too. The human population is 500,000 on the globe, 1750. Billion. And it goes up to, we're now 7+, on the edge of 8. But see what the dramatic difference is. At 1901, the human population was 1.6 billion, the beginning of the last century. By the end of that century, the numbers flipped, 6.1 billion. Now we're adding a billion most every decade. And it's not because of family size. Family size is going down overall. It's because people are living longer. I'm living a generation longer than my father. That's not uncommon at all these days. That's one reason. The second reason is that children are surviving childhood. There was a time when it was about 40% of the children didn't make age 5. That's in the past. So we're living longer, people are surviving, and the population is going up even though family size is going down. And that will continue if longevity continues to increase and public health for the younger years continues to improve. All right. So this is unprecedented human well-being, really. Again, I'm speaking overall. It isn't for everybody, but it's for more and more people. What are the consequences for planetary systems of this population and GDP and the Great Collision? The top three are greenhouse gases. CO2 concentration, you see where it's gone. Starts with the Industrial Revolution, it's kind of low, and then it's kind of slow until 1900, then it really takes off after 1950, 1960, and it's continuing. All of these trend lines are continuing up. They're not leveling off. This only goes to 2000, but I should try to get an update. There are updates. And then the next one is nitrous oxide, and then the third one over in the top is methane. And all of them are increasing. People are really worried about methane now because so much of it is in the tundra, which is thawing. Atmosphere ozone depletion, we came to a good treaty in Montreal that has addressed this in part, but it's still a big issue. Climate, northern hemisphere average surface temperatures are going up, floods, drought and deluge, both increasing. Ocean ecosystems, the biochemistry of the oceans is changing. Coastal zone structures are changing largely because of human development on coastal zones. Loss of tropical rainforest and woodland, increase in the amount of domesticated land, and the one that many scientists worry most about is the killing off of so many species, the loss of biodiversity, both flora and fauna. Why? Because biodiversity is the repertoire by which life adjusts to major changes. If you lose biodiversity, you lose the kind of variety that can, then something will adapt and something will emerge. But if you shut down that repertoire, you lose that. So what I'm trying to say is that one reason it's so hard for us to come to terms with climate system change is because we have benefited so immensely from the Industrial Revolution and its consequences that we just don't want to give up. Tell me when you heard a presidential candidate, including Barack Obama, a presidential candidate argue against economic growth. Ain't going to happen. People talk about fear. This gives us all kinds of fears. And one of them is that we fear if the economy doesn't continue doing what it's doing and provide more jobs and provide more goods and provide more services. So that this first page, even though it results in this, is the second page. Now, the consequence is that we continue doing the first page in light of what's happening in the second page. The riskiest thing we can do is carry on business as usual. That's the riskiest thing we can do, is to do what we've been doing. So, anybody got any fears? I'm influenced by James Baldwin. James Baldwin said one time, in the church I go to, he was a young preacher at an earlier age. He gave up on the church later. But in the church I go to, which is not the same as the one white Americans go to, we were counseled from time to time to do our first works over. To do our first works over. Go back as far as you can and tell the truth about where you've come from. Sing about it, shout about it, or keep it to yourself, but know whence you came. We're now at a time when we have to do our first works over. First works means the basic systems and structures and habits of our lives. So that's good advice. And to know how we got here. All right, now I'm going to just take a little bit of time and say something about the ethics side of this conversation of Bible and ethics. The way we have imagined our moral responsibility in most quarters, among most people who have lived since 1750 under the influence of the Euro-West, the age of colonization, conquest, colonization, commerce, and Christianity all wrapped together to establish neo-European societies on every single continent except Antarctica. The way in which our moral responsibility has been understood is that it's human to human. To whom are we responsible? Who is the neighbor that we are to love in Christianity with our heart, soul, and mind? The picture you get is another human being. So it's an assumption of a moral world or our moral responsibility that says the moral universe is human society and the way folks can get along and exercise that responsibility, whether it's as parents or it's as colleagues or it's as a we and a they and they're getting along, conflict, etc. It's all human to human. It's all human society. What does that do when that's your moral universe? It excludes the impact of your own way of life on the other than human world. So, unless you're a member of one of the indigenous peoples, you don't ask, what moral claim does air, the atmosphere, have on me? What is my responsibility to water? What moral claim does soil have on my life? Those questions didn't arise in this understanding of ethics because we thought it's only human to human, which it certainly is. So all of this, the outer circle here is the ecosphere. That's the planet. I'm just calling it the ecosphere, which is everything together. And then it has connections to stardust. It has connections to the atmosphere. But this is all a kind of, in economics, you talk about externalities, where you haven't accounted in the price for everything that went into the making of that consequence because you refine your fossil fuels without having to pay the price for keeping the air clean, for example. keeping the atmosphere clean wasn't included in the price you paid at the pump. Okay, we did that for a whole lot of life on the planet. We excluded that sector when we talked about what then are we to do? How are we to live? So this is kind of the Industrial Revolution's picture of the moral universe. But if now our actions have consequences for all of this, go permeate all ecological systems, create the future of life for all the children in Barry's sense, determine the direction of evolution itself by what we do or don't fail to do, then we better change our sense of moral responsibility. Now, what does that include? And here I just want to do Ethics 101 because we'll come back to some of these things. As Anthony said in the earlier session, talking about Aquinas, whose ethics is a virtue ethic, in the virtue ethic you're focusing on the qualities of character that ought to be ours. What are we nourishing in the way of courage or humility? all of those things that make for a good person, or vices are often virtues gone bad that don't work in later circumstances. But that happened with the Protestant ethics. It was really, really good to work hard under this paradigm of the Industrial Revolution and save and not spend. That provided the basis for the rise of capitalism. And it was, again, in many ways, the right way at the right time. But now, to continue to focus strictly on those virtues has led to what Max Weber calls the iron cage. We built ourselves an iron cage in which everything is determined by our kind of economy. Will we free ourselves from the kind of economy that is in collision with the economy in which it's based, the economy of nature? So, do we need to think about what the virtues are for the early Anthropocene? What ought now to be our qualities of character? And societies have character. So that's why we talk about American values and what they are, what they ought to be, and there are going to be lots of fights about them. So that's that. Another element of any full-bodied ethic are the consequences of our actions. David Brooks did a piece in the New York Times. He said, this is what it's all about, are the consequences of our actions. So you measure then, what are good consequences, what are bad consequences? I put in parentheses utility, because we have thought about consequences in terms of how they serve human welfare. But what happens in the early Anthropocene? What happens when you cannot know the consequences of your actions? Because they are a part of systems, economic systems, for example, that ramify for generations and interact with one another. You don't know the consequences of your actions. In this kind of interplay of systems for the long haul and at levels we've never imagined, we can't know the consequences. So what do you do then? How do you live if you can't know the eventual outcome of what you or we are doing? So, big issue for ethics. And then obligation or duty, those are the moral bottom lines. Where do you stand and say, here I stand, I can do no other? Where do you stand? What are your moral bottom lines? It might be, you know, no matter what happens, I'm going to protect my family. Or if you're a thoroughgoing pacifist, you say, no matter what happens, I am not going to take another life. we've all got moral bottom lines. And what are the moral bottom lines that are appropriate to the early Anthropocene? Now, are they different? They may not be. Are they different from the late Holocene? I think some of the virtues are clearly different. We need some sense of ourselves. We need some measure of humility, because human beings in the Industrial Revolution actually continued a version of the master-slave ethic. Human beings are masters; the rest of nature is slave. It's there to be used for our welfare, and we will make the decision about its use and well-being. That's the master-slave ethic. applied to nature. So maybe there's a place for humility. What does life want from us? Rather than what do we want from life? Controlling, mastering and controlling nature is not working out well, people. Earth has become defiant. It's acting against our interests as a consequence of the way we have treated it. So think about these elements. Now I want to just show you a diagram of the moral life in the Anthropocene. The line has been erased from human society only as the sphere of responsibility, and the line now is coterminous with the planet itself as a community of life. So we need to say, you know, what air requires of us, what water requires of us, what kinds of energy are the best, and what do they require of us? What are all the primal elements, which are the generative parental elements of life, earth, air, fire, and water? What do those primal elements ask of us? What is our responsibility in light of their life? Okay, does anybody have some quick response on ideas for virtues and consequences and moral bottom lines? Might be the same ones we have now, might be different ones.
Yeah, I guess when you say what do you do if you don't know what the end is?
Yeah.
I guess for myself, I only can trust in learned people that study the effects. And even though they just use models, they can't be absolutely sure. You've got to grab a hold of something.
Yes.
And I know it's not much, and I think that's the problem with people, you know, that say they don't believe in global warming because they don't have any idea of people that are studying it.
Yeah. Yeah, we better be careful about, and we better pay attention to what's happening in the detail. That's why science is absolutely indispensable to our responsibility in the Anthropocene. We have to know what's going on. It is so out of keeping with what we have assumed. And this is just a climate summit. And you see the list on the agenda here: energy independence, preserve rainforest, sustainability, green jobs, livable cities, renewables, clean water and air, healthy children, et cetera, et cetera. And here. But what if it's a big hoax, climate change, and we create a better world for nothing? You know, have to understand what's going on. And science is a major vehicle. It's not the only one. The difficulty that scientists themselves tell you is they doing science doesn't provide its own meaning. It doesn't tell you how to value what's been described, what to do with it. That's why scientists are generally very hesitant to do more than tell you in detail what's going on. But telling you in detail doesn't interpret its meaning and doesn't tell you what to do with it. Yeah. Okay. Any other responses to moral responsibility?
Well, so is it, you understand that this is real, that humans are a geological force now?
Yeah.
Probably everyone in this room understands that, but some very influential people in our world either don't understand that or pretend that it's not true. And what is our moral responsibility to try to change that? Is it to elect people to government positions that
yeah.
that will admit this, that will
yeah.
consider at least humility as an option.
yeah. Or consider some other kind of economy. I mean, some of it may just be you're up against people who are science deniers.
Yeah.
And that is not an authority for them. And there are a variety of reasons for that. I think one of them is that all of us have an uncanny capacity to sense what is not in our best interest. And if it asks for a big change of life, we just don't want to go there. So we'll pick authorities that do. Yeah, here and then. It may be a response. This is a big and important question. So
a bit of a response. I think I wonder if a character of the old Holocene is that someone with more power, more authority will solve it for me.
Uh-huh.
And I see, I think, a character or virtue that's emerging in the early stages of the Anthropocene of, I mean, it goes under lots of different titles, but slow food movement.
Yeah.
A local, a reinvestment in a smaller territory.
Yeah.
As opposed, and it, I don't think it's a bit of a response to globalization. There still has to be some bigger picture, but to say what patience, slow, smaller,
yeah.
simplicity.
Yeah. Small is Beautiful was the book a long time ago, but it still has currency. No,
you as an individual, are you talking about the individual, the smaller community? As me, you can do that now, besides the voting and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't drink coffee, don't eat bananas.
You know, really,
that's
serious.
Yes.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Just to say that I think it's really becoming quite clear that you need actions at a global level. That's why something like the Paris Climate Agreement is so important. You get a commitment on the part of nations and collectivities and institutions. There are a lot of institutions, or there, other than nations, you have signatories to the Paris Climate Agreement. Mayors have gone on record for it. In New Mexico, we've got a thing that goes out to congregations. Will congregations work for the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement? So you need leadership at this level, and we have Barack Obama and his initiative with the head of China not to give up on when the Copenhagen talks, on COP talks, Conference of the Parties, fell apart earlier. They hung in there. And they helped to bring this off. Okay, that's at that level. But the other level is both individual and local, I kind of think, because global supply lines are very long, but you can shorten them. And it's easier to exercise your responsibility if you are doing it with people you see and with whom you can work. And so Bill McKibben in the book Earth looks to farmers markets as a kind of one instance of knowing where your food comes from, a mutually beneficial relationship with the farmer, knowing the nutrition of it, and helping out in the community. Our farmers market in Santa Fe has a film festival in which they have films on food issues. You know, I have often told students where they live in communities with farm markets, just check out the quality of human relationships. Tell me how many good conversations you had in the supermarket other than thank you when the person says, have a great day. It used to be a good day. Have a great day when you check out, you know. But other than that, you had no conversations in the supermarket. You go to the farmer's market, and it's buzz, buzz, buzz in conversation with them. And some of them invite you up there. You come up and camp out. Kids can ride the ponies. You can help pick the crops, if you will. I mean, there are developing relationships which are local, and the sense of responsibility has gone down to shorter lines rather than the long lines.
An alternative?
Pardon?
We belong to a CSA.
Yeah.
Consumer Supported Agriculture.
Yeah.
We buy a percentage of the guy's crop. If it has a failure, we fail. If it does well, we do well.
Yeah. Our church in New York, when we lived in New York and not Santa Fe, was a drop-off place for members of the CSA, a Community Supported Agriculture. And the problem is that you get too many zucchini one week, and not enough of something else. So what happened was, it's no longer the place, I don't think. What happened was people brought recipes for making use of all of that particular crop that was the season for. And then at one point, once a month, we had a potluck where people, having done something with the week before, brought it in, and you develop a kind of community there. That's a way of scaling down to make responsibility and community viable in ways that it isn't simply by shopping the big stores. Yeah, okay. Other responsibilities or where you would stand? Yes.
Just a moment of testimony. It can be a family thing. Our family has 6 all-electric cars.
Uh-huh. Do you?
To drive. So try an electric car.
Yeah, do you? That's a good one. 6 of them. Woo! We're a little, Nyla and I are a little puffed up about ourselves. We have a plug-in Prius, and we have the solar panels to provide the electricity so we don't have to have coal-fired electricity to put in our electric car. But it's not a totally electric car. It's a plug-in Prius, so it's got the hybrid motor. But Santa Fe is small enough that we can drive it and do all of our shopping and other runs in Santa Fe on strictly electricity powered by our solar panels.
What
yes.
The fact that most people can't afford cars like that.
And can't afford farmers market either.
Right, well, that could
so,
be.
Yes. That part of that is ballot box. How are you going to vote? And what kind of policies are you going to push for to scale up these improvements, you know? In farmers market, the WIC stamps are there. And you can use the food stamps at the farmers market. That helps out a little bit there, but it's nonetheless. Yeah, but the electric cars are for people who have some discretionary income. But what you can work on is like West Harlem Environmental Action in New York pushed hard after so many kids in the grade schools that were located near the bus barns or the bus depots where the city buses come at the end of the route and start at the beginning of the route. All of that exhaust was causing a lot of respiratory problems among the kids in the neighborhood. One of them happened to be just across the street from a big grade school. And West Harlem Environmental Action, through lots of hard work, got New York City to have only hybrid buses and buses on natural gas. And so they don't have the problem anymore. That's a public transportation issue. And you can go clean energy with public transportation too. Yeah, Carol.
Yeah, this is just sort of a comment that in the current political climate of deep polarization, I fear what's happening. I mean, that any kind of environmental sensible activity, which, in previous political times may be viewed as almost conservative, sensible, local kind of stuff, is now part of the, we'll get to sort of the identity politics, the reaction. I mean, if you go to the farmer's market, you drive an electric car, you're not part of, going back to that earlier, you're not part of that tribe, or you talked at the beginning about, you're not, And that is really, I think some people are becoming more anti-science because of Trump. People's views are people are being changed. I mean, his supporters, by this polarization, by what he says, and so it's very hard. It's harder to find middle ground and sensible, local. I mean, if you live in Washington, Western Washington, it's one thing. If you live, in the middle of Eastern Washington, it's another. It's making all of this more difficult.
It is. It certainly is. Paul Tillich used to say that the psychoses and neuroses get most intense in times of deep transition, and they surface. And a friend, Tex Sample, has a book coming out. I haven't seen it. It's not out yet. It's called White Rage. And so the race issues also get more vocal. They've been there all the time. But something happens in these times. And now we've got a situation where some of these things are being normalized that really have to be addressed differently. I hope other people have better ideas. I think we ought to be asking folks who are on opposite sides on many issues what they want for their children. What kind of world is it that you want to pass along to your children and your grandchildren, and see if there are some common values that come out of that. Now, you're still going to end up having to make some basic decisions at the ballot box, the policy proposals, but you may well have grounds for talking with one another by putting it out there as what do you want to leave behind. It's always interesting to me to read eulogies, because what do people want? It doesn't matter. They might have been scoundrels in their lives. What do they want? They want to be remembered as a good community citizen, or a good grand husband and father. So appeal to that side of people. Yes.
And I would add, as you ask the question and listen to the response you get, don't let them off the hook. Pursue.
Yes. Yeah, you got to go somewhere with us. Yeah.
Don't allow a platitude to be enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I find when I look at what's been happening here, that a lot of the conflicts that separate different groups, put them in we-they camps, actually go down the middle of us. I mean, I find myself looking at the consequences of climate system change and then looking away. I really don't want to give up that. That's why I think the summer theme at Holden, Fear Not, is so important. How do you live then with the fears that are genuine, or as Anthony was talking about it earlier? I mean, there's reason for these fears. Now the response, may treat them as excessive or wrong in other ways. But to recognize my immersion or my life as a person of white privilege brings up dimensions of race that I might otherwise look away from, and maybe helps understand white rage. It isn't to accept platitudes about it or say, well, everybody, it's good people on both sides. That's not the point. The point is to recognize there's something in ourselves which you also see in the fears of others. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Steve.
Another way to think about the children question.
Yeah.
Actually, I understand there's like an earlier version of the golden rule that it may come from the Torah or something. I had to check me on this, but it was like, what would the world be like if everyone acted as you did?
Yeah.
Which is sort of an upside down. It's like you anticipate the consequence, which you talked about.
Yes.
Whatever choice you make. So that can be either positive or negative. If we all do something that alleviates suffering, then the world is a better place. If we contribute to suffering, then the world is a worse place.
Yeah. Thank you. A couple of quick responses, and people can pick up on this. Wendell Berry, another Berry here. His version of the golden rule is, do unto those downstream from you what you would have those upstream from you do unto you. And I think that's pretty good, you know. But Jim Forrest was an activist in opposing the war in Vietnam. And he happened to be an acquaintance of the monk, Thomas Merton. And Jim Forrest wasn't knocking his head against the wall with all of his friends getting nowhere in the opposition or in bringing the Vietnam War to an end. And he wrote to Thomas Merton about his despair about not getting anywhere. And Thomas Merton writes a letter back, and it's called Letter to a Young Activist. I can't cite it word for word. The upshot of it is, Thomas Merton says, you know, your action should be characterized by nonviolent love. Do them in that spirit and let God and the universe sort it out. The point is, if your actions aren't achieving that immediate goal that you want, or even if they were successful in stopping the war in Vietnam in this case, to have your relationships foster nonviolent love is likelier to produce what you were just reading from there. The consequences are much likelier to be better for the world than worse for the world. So it's a way of taking what up here was obligation or duty, what are my moral bottom lines, and relating it to relationships that have consequences, even when I can't, and as I can't, know what they are. Other responses to what should be our stances? What are some examples of being Anthropocene people instead of late Holocene people?
Well, I think talking about consequences and the idea of utility and the conversations that we have with people, I think you seem very committed to a different way of economy. You know,
we'd
like to get away from capitalism. I think we all know that's going to be pretty difficult.
Yes.
We would all like everyone to agree on the science, and we know that's pretty difficult. So sort of a utilitarian idea of talking to people in the way that works for them, and talking to them, like you were talking about how, you know, what do you want for your grandchildren? Mm-hmm. Another way is to talk to conservatives in the way that works for them about how, even though it's not what we would ideally want, like green energy creates more jobs. Global warming has national security consequences. So these are ways we can talk to conservatives, people across the aisle that maybe is not ideal for what we believe, but works for them. And just a quick plug, I learned this from a organization called Citizens Climate Lobby.
Yes.
And where it's a bipartisan organization working on legislation to put a price on carbon. That's like the only thing that they work on. And despite what it looks like, we're actually having success.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans say they believe in climate change. They believe it's a problem. They want some action. And personally, I am the person who
sees climate change and has to look away because I cannot take it. And working with them has been a way to do something and not just live in fear.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. Doing one thing. I had a wonderful sabbatical a long time ago, and I spent it by going to communities on four different continents where the experience had been that of experiencing social injustice and environmental degradation together, because the sources of the social injustice and the environmental degradation were intertwined. And these were communities of the poor in the Philippines, Alaska, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Scotland. And I spent a week with each of them, and I had researched Egypt too, in the desert in Egypt. I had researched the communities, so I had my agenda, my questions. And I came back to Union and had this kind of shock of sorts that the Union students, all of whom were relatively privileged, they could go and get a master's degree, were the ones that were despondent on both the social justice and the environmental well-being fronts. But I hadn't experienced that in those communities. And I said, what was going on there? Why did these communities have energy to do what they were doing and some fun together? So, I mean, community meaning together. And it turned out, upon further reflection, to be two things, essentially. One is that they all had some kind of rituals that let's exorcise the demons. So at the center for, let's see, what was it? The Marinol Center in the Philippines. That whole center had been wiped out in a terrible earthquake in Baguio. And the sisters who had worked with both the urban communities in Baguio and poverty and housing, jobs and housing issues, and with the communities in the countryside where timbering and mining had polluted the rice paddies that were their sustenance. They had worked with both of them, and now the convent and schools were all destroyed in the earthquake. Well, they did two things. One, they rebuilt the buildings using all recycled materials, basically what had come down. Only they did it with cutting edge kind of technology, so passive solar and so on and so forth. Extremely high end in terms of energy efficiency. Facilities and beautiful facilities because they employed Philippine artists. But then the Center for the Integrity of Creation, that's what they called it, was the gathering point for meetings to address these issues. Every meeting began with a dance. It were the students from the School for the Deaf, which was the one school they retained. The rest were stations of the Journey of the Universe outdoors. So you went and saw the whole universe unfold in these different stations. Instead of Stations of the Cross, it was Stations for the of the Universe. But and the doorway that you went through, instead of Dante's "All ye who enter here, abandon hope," it was "All ye who enter here, enjoy!" So, but every meeting started with the students from the school, from the deaf, doing a dance. Now, they couldn't hear the music. These were huge drums, and they could actually feel the drum beat. And that was to exorcise, to get rid of the demons of hopelessness and helplessness. That's how the day started. That's how the meeting started. So you had some ritualizing that put you in the place that you needed to be. And the other thing is right in line with your comment. The outcome of any meeting was to decide what one thing can we do. And then go do it, or start doing it. And you have a kind of hiding hand that pulls you in. If you do that one thing, you find that you can do one thing, and then you do sort of the next thing. So I think that focus of climate action, they're very clear, the folks who had that up. We're going to only work on this. We're going to work on it in a bipartisan way, and we're going to work on it that appeals to all sides, because the market arguments for climate or for a carbon tax are strong. You get conservative economists on board there, as well as liberal economists. I think that's just brilliant, and that's what we need to do, is find one thing that we can do. Yeah. All right, we're going to finish. These are two-hour sessions, and I didn't let anybody have a potty break. But we'll just take a few more minutes. And I just want to show you one more slide, because it sets the context. Eduardo, there's Eduardo. And 6 months instead of 3.5 years. We didn't get to Bible today, but our next question is where, if we've got this dramatically changed context, do we go for wisdom? The Bible gets written across many dramatically changed contexts. And what happens in so much of Scripture, especially in the Hebrew Bible, is that people reach back to an earlier establishment of themselves as the people of God and retell the stories. And this week, the stories are rich and in different contexts, different wisdom emerges. Glenn Jordan will be doing the Book of Ruth. He did it last week. Wonderful sessions on the Book of Ruth for crossing borders. Immigration issues, for example. Things will jump out at you from the Book of Ruth that didn't know were there. They're in those stories. So where do we go for wisdom? And what we're going to do on Wednesday and Friday is look to the Bible as a source for wisdom in a different epoch. Been through some climate change there too. Noah could tell you a little bit about that. In fact, I saw the beginning sentence of an article in the New York Times, I think it was a week ago Sunday, talked about changes are happening of biblical proportions, you know. Oh, now where did that come from? They are happening of biblical proportions. All of the different dimensions of faith and of religious traditions will now come into play again. We'll have to ask about these different dimensions because of deeply changed contexts. These are also the dimensions of every way of life. There's a cosmology. The cosmology is your big picture. How do you understand reality? I realize if someone comes up and asks you, what's your cosmology doing for you today? You might have to say, I'll get back to you on that. because we're not very articulate about our understanding of reality. But it functions in a way that it shapes how we see things, and how we respond. So what is your cosmology? Is your cosmology that of the moral responsibility as human to human only? Has it been expanded so that it's more than that wider world? It makes a difference. Community, and so cosmology is your orienting function. How do you lean into the world? That's your cosmology, is heavily influential. Community, where you're grounded. We're social creatures. We're actually eco-social creatures by nature. We insist on belonging. I work in a juvenile detention center for 3 years. Kids joined gangs because they wanted to belong. We're born to belonging. So the question is then, what kind of community? And if you don't have community, if you're a true loner, especially if you're a young male loner, you're probably a desperate person and a danger to others. So community as grounding your life. Ritual, I gave you one example of how that is. We ritualize everything. We ritualize greeting one another, meeting one another. We ritualize food. We ritualize sex. We ritualize dying. We ritualize getting together in bonds of commitment to one another. We are ritualizing creatures. What are the appropriate rituals for the Anthropocene? Maybe ones we've had, maybe need some new ones. How do you ritualize your relationship to future generations you will not see? Is there a way we could distill the meaning of the relationship we want and have with them and put it into a ritual? That's one where we might need some we don't have, because when we say love your neighbor, we think of somebody who's living and we think it's a person. What about the neighbor that are one of the children who's swimming in the sea? Either in the present or a century from now. Is there a ritual for loving the neighbor? And are there other manifestations of the arts? I think the arts are so critical because they can help distill this meaning and put it in an image and a form that lets us grab hold of it. Ethics is about how the gap between what is and what ought to be. How do we cross that gap? We live in that, in the tension of is and ought. So there's always a moral and ethical component. And then it says personal here on awakening. All these people mean by that is that each and every one of us has an inner journey that we're on that's related to the outer journey that we're on. So how do we nurture that kind of spirituality of who we are? And wish to be. That's what's called personal. It's not individual. It's deeply personal. It pertains to us as individuals, but it's the inner life as related to the rest of life, if you will. Okay, I think we're just going to close on a semicolon and go have lunch. Okay. Do some Bible on Wednesday. I do.
I have two computers.
Yeah.
We can't trust science. Online. And the other is you can't prove it.
You can't prove it?
As far as okay. I have 35 years of experience
writing models.
Writing
models? Oh, yeah.
And I met and talked with the guy that says, no, Colorado, who wrote the original story. He's still up there. Anyway, The line with the door,
right outside.
I can't press the science because they can
throw my jacket in there.
That's the method.
Would be right below where I am.
You could, or we could.
Did you find it, Rose?
Days earlier of a hurricane. Within about plus or minus 300 miles.
Dining hall, that guy.
In other words, we could tell which state would be here.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same confidence, 95% confidence, they were in a row of 50 plus or minus 10.
Yes.
First of all, we got in a fight. Okay, so that's the yeah, they keep on changing their story. It's better.
Yeah.
The other one is proof. You can't prove this that it's going to ever happen. And that's a total misunderstanding of what proof is. Proof is, I've got a set of statements which I consider to be true, and a logic system, and I can trace a path through that logic system from these guys to this thing that I'm calling proof.
Yeah.
Proof. Okay. If I have a proof, and one of the initial assumptions that I'm going with is wrong, the proof is still valid. Mm-hmm. It just is that the thing that was proven is not true.
Yeah.
In other words, proof does not mean truth.
Yeah.
And people seem to think that proof means truth.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah. 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 These would be good to also bring up as we go along here. There's so much to talk about in the relationship to science. Yeah.
The guy that does the model?
Yes.
In the atmosphere, he goes up 60, 60 levels, he samples, right?
Really?
I asked him, what about in the ocean? In the ocean, he only has enough computer space to do 6 levels.
Oh.
Major floats that are totally missed.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what he was doing. He was at Intel trying to convince them they had to build this better computer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, I had a wife when I was young.
Yeah.
I have a question. It's an easy one for you. You started one of your talks years ago with 3 chairs.
And yes.
The 3 chairs whose present are the people without a voice.
Yeah.
And that's the children?
Future generations,
the poor in creation,
and the natural world. Those were the 3 chairs.
Okay, at least it was served.
I had forgotten about it. Nigel reminds me now and again. I had forgotten about it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And put them right out there in front where everybody can see that they're empty.
I've stolen that from you. But I haven't lost it. I had a double check.
Yeah, it was actually a Danish pastor who used that the first time.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't invent that.
It's so simple.
Yeah.
It's so clear.
Yeah. No. I'm going to turn this thing off.
Thank you, Larry. How would you like to stay for the next year?
Got to go home and tend my garden.
I know. And grandchildren.
Yeah.
Is the book. Right. Okay, so here... look at this on page 77. We had to learn ourselves, and furthermore, we had to teach the despairing man that it did not really matter what we expected from life, but rather what life expected from us. Can you believe
my
that?
Gosh. Life ultimately means taking the responsibility to find the end and to fulfill the task for which consciously sets.
So here we are. We're doing exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. We're reading this 50-year-old text in a new world.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like...
Let me write this down, Steve.
Okay.
Frankel, I'll remember where it is.
Yeah. Page 7, of course, it might be.
Yeah, it'll be.
Yeah.
But.
So So it's toward, you know, it's towards the conclusion of his, you know, his concentration.
Yeah, but what's the, who's published this version?
Oh, okay.
Because it would be easy to find. Beacon, okay.
Yeah.
Of Beacon Press.
2006 print.
Yeah, that's a real revival.
Yeah. Oh, first published in 46. I thought it was older than 59. Okay, I wish I'd paid attention to that, but yeah.
Yeah, thank you. That's exactly the question. We got it backwards. Yeah, you know?
Yeah. The other thing that I think is also coincident here is like it's usual. Every person matters. If you're removed from the world, if you remove yourself from the world, say you commit suicide in a concentration camp, what you could have done, no one else will ever do.
Yeah,
you know, it's like it's unique for each individual,
uh-huh.
and that's what we're talking about now is individual responsibility.
Yeah,
that's
really
wonderful.
There's a fabulous book by Robin Kimmerer, K-I-M-M-E-R-E-R, called Braiding Sweetgrass, and she's a botanist trained in Western science, a rather prominent one, but she rediscovers her own indigenous Potawatomi roots, and she learned. And she finds out that plants are teachers and not just objects to be classified that we know about, but we have to listen to them and so on so forth. But so for her, is what is life asking of us? But her point is that it's such a reciprocal relationship that it comes down to each individual's actions. And nobody can replace anyone. I mean,
right.
We all have ours, and yours is not mine, mine is not yours, and you've done something, or I've done something else. But all of them matter. You know?
Well, yeah, and that's when you're going through the virtue ethics, one of the thoughts I had is like, we might need a new virtue ethic that says, I believe that whatever I do matters, no matter how small.
Yeah, that's
most
good.
Of us feel powerless, like, why should I vote, or, you know, whatever it actually... Every single thing matters.
And it's also literally true. I mean, we got to this point because of a zillion small acts. And you're gonna get to somewhere else because of another zillion.
Well, it's a little bit like what Glenn was talking about, like whatever development that got us to this crisis, it'll take us that long to get back out of it.
Thanks, Steve. I gotta figure out how to turn this off.
Oh. It looks like it just turned. Nope. No.
No, when I press the remote, it doesn't do it.
Yeah, I thought it went off for a second.
No. Did that do it?
Nope.
No, it's still on.
Oh. You push it twice.
Push it twice?
The blue button.
The remote?
The remote. Twice. And even at that.
Yeah, that's great. I hope you were that way.